This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
So again, welcome. To start our morning off this Saturday of this theme weekend, thinking about agency, thinking about what traditionally has been called dominion in Christian teaching, what Ben defined well last night as power rightly expressed, rightly used in the world, part of our God-given capacity. I want to spend some time looking through a recent book, a book called The Vanishing American Adult, Our Coming-of-Age Crisis and How to Rebuild a Culture of Self-Reliance. But as a way into this book, I want to share something from a completely different book, a book that's called The Art of Betrayal. It's by Gordon Correra. He is the BBC's security correspondent. And so this is from his 2011 book, The Art of Betrayal. And he talks about a recently declassified intelligence document that was written during the Cold War and explained to field agents the kind of person who can be turned, someone who could be convinced to commit treason and spy against their own country. So agents were instructed to look for the following things, to keep an eye out for this sort of person. And they needed this instruction because at this point, these people weren't, this wasn't a common thing. They were told to keep an eye out for those who evidenced emotional fragility, who were immature and insecure, disconnected from strong community, from accountability, and from deep relationships, yet who sought to make an impact in order to gain a sense of self-worth. Now, if you're anything like me, hearing this description, you're thinking, is this describing me? Or your mind is racing to all sorts of people. You know, here we are 50 years later, and this doesn't sound like describing the characteristics of someone. It wouldn't be hard to find someone, people, young people in particular, who fit these characteristics. People who are isolated, lonely, immature, insecure, emotionally fragile, but carrying lofty goals or aspirations of making a difference. It seems that each week we're met with a new study or an editorial bemoaning the state of young people in our country and in the Western world, especially around hot-button issues like work ethic and resilience. And there is a lot to bemoan, which is maybe why some of you are here, concerned about the state of agency or initiative or dominion in our world today, or the lack thereof. And if you weren't here last night, and even if you were, I just want to briefly go through how we're thinking about dominion. Dominion as power rightly expressed. Ben made talked about dominion is using power well, power that God gives all people, the ability to do things with the world, to make a difference. And it's sort of walking along the edge of a roof. This is not just a triangle, this is a roof. And there's two common ways to fall off the roof. On one side, there's domination, taking over. On the other side, there's abdication, fleeing from our power or misusing our power oppressively. And if there's probably one side that more and more of our culture is falling off on, it's the abdication side, the fleeing side. And it seems like the culture, the trajectory in our culture is towards passivity, irresponsibility, and perpetual adolescence. Adolescence is a vital season, this in-between time between childhood and adulthood, where one is dependent, but one is growing in their own agency. And it's always towards the end of becoming an adult, which is a wonderful thing. It's a season of life which isn't and hasn't always been a part of each culture, but is a part of ours, or it has been. But it seems as though people's expectations or people's experience of adolescence continues to swell. It's getting larger and larger. And this is a culturally destructive thing, to be in a state of perpetual adolescence. And so if this is a concern you share, I want to commend the work of Republican Senator Ben Sasse, his book, The Vanishing American Adult. And we're going to walk through this. And just to be clear, you did hear me correctly. He is a Republican senator, and he's written a book that I think is worth considering. It might be hard for some of us to swallow, but it's true. And maybe it comes from the fact that he's from Nebraska. He comes from a small community. He's a hardworking guy, grew up on a farm. He also then studied government at Harvard, did a classics degree at St. John's. Then he did not one, but two master's degrees in U.S. history at Yale, and then did a PhD in U.S. history at Yale. And he never intended to become a politician. He wanted to go into education. So maybe suspend your, I think, legitimate distrust of politicians for a moment and give this guy a chance. It's a great book. It's full of a lot of anecdotes as well as a lot of research. And on top of this, he's also a Christian. He's a person of faith that comes out very clearly throughout this book. He even named his son Augustine after the 4th century, which is kind of a 4th century Christian pastor. Kind of a weird thing, but he doesn't call his son Augustine. They call him Breck, which is the nickname, which is a little... If you're going to name your son Augustine, it's at least nice to give him a nickname instead of calling him Augustine all the time. And I'll say that this is not a wholesale endorsement of everything in the book, nor his political record. The New York Times, when they reviewed this book, said in some ways it amounts to a self-help book for well-to-do parents. There's some stuff in this book, some of his remedies for the vanishing American adult, do require resources and time and finances that not all Americans can give. But it's no reason to dismiss the book. Emma Green, who's a religion writer for The Atlantic, she gives a significantly more robust engagement with Sasse and his overall project. She says he's after this: the rehabilitation of shared values in a time of intense difference. And I would add intense indifference. And he wants to focus on culture, cultivating culture as the deepest challenge of our politics. He wants us to grow in the ability to imagine virtue as part of who we are as citizens. And he wants this especially for emerging adults, those who are leaving adolescence and moving into adulthood. And his program is something of a cross between a boot camp and a great book seminar. He longs to revitalize the way we imagine what it means to be an adult, to do things with this world, to have responsibility, to exercise agency, to exercise dominion, as we said. But what does it mean to be an adult in North America today? Sasse asked this question. And he says the common answer is living for 6,574 days. Which is 18 years. There's little qualitative difference in Sasse's mind between being 17 and 3/4 and being 18. Not much has necessarily happened. But it is a legal and a cultural milestone. You now have the right to own property, the right to make contracts, the right to vote, the right to register for the draft, and it's all automatic. You have to wait a few more years to buy alcohol. You have to wait a few more years then to rent a car. But you've kind of emerged into adulthood. And he says that sociologists talk about 8 markers, which have traditionally defined adulthood, things that go on around this time of coming to 18. So there's 8 markers. Moving out of a parent's home, leaving school for the final time, some sort of terminal degree, getting a full-time job, reaching economic self-sufficiency, being able to sort of pay your bills, loss of virginity, getting married, having kids, and then establishing an independent household. Things that start happening around this season of life. And he sees that there's less and less of these things happening. These no longer define or characterize people moving into adulthood. He says, but 18 is still imprinted on our psyche. For some reason, you turn 18, you've become an adult, regardless of what milestones or characteristics you've crossed. And he thinks there's 2 reasons for this. at least two reasons. The first is the spread of secondary schooling, and then compulsory attendance laws. Everyone needs to be in school. Sass cites how in the 1890s, less than 10% of 14 to 17-year-olds were in school, which means almost 9 out of 10 were already working. He said by 1930, they were more than half were in school, and by 1945, three-quarters were in school. And it continued to rise till today, where it's ubiquitous. They all are. So secondary schooling, and part of that was the Industrial Revolution and the rise of factory work and very good laws that kept kids out of factories. Very good thing. Factories aren't places for 14 and 17-year-olds to spend their day. And so he says that secondary schooling became the norm. He said, so they spend time in school. Prior to spending time in school, childhood had previously been thought of as a training ground. Children were not baby Einsteins, but little citizens. He says they were not to be coddled, but encouraged to contribute more and more to the good of their community. 14 to 17-year-olds assumed to be committing, or not committing, doing good, contributing good to their community. And there's, he goes through a fascinating series of mores and lesses to see this transformation of how we've moved from thinking about young people as being people who contribute to the good of a community, instead being people who, young people who are just supposed to be in school, are just supposed to be kind of absorbing. And so he has these things that have contributed, they're more or lesses. So the first one, is more meds. Kids receive more meds now than ever. And this is a tricky thing, and he admits this, because for many people, medication is a lifesaver. It is a good thing. He's very clear about that. He says, but prior to the 1980s, young people's problems were rarely thought of in mental health terms, clinical mental health terms. Now, again, I'm not making a definitive claim on the legitimacy or illegitimacy of meds. I think they're very helpful for a lot of people. But Sass walks through how large and how quickly these industries, these medication industries, have grown and how it feeds an idea that young people's problems are way too big for them to handle. And that you have to outsource it. There's not resources within you to deal with these things. You need something from outside of you. The second thing he goes through is more screen time. Kids, more and more time in front of screens for young people. Now, there's an overwhelming amount of information here, both in Sass's book and in other books. I'm going to share two things, and this is about video games. He works with two social psychologists named Philip Zimbardo and Nikita Colombe, and they have a book called Man Interrupted. And they estimate that many relatively average young American males have played more than 14,000 hours of video games by the time they turn 21. And if you haven't done that math in your head, that is 583 days of straight video game playing. It's over a year and a half of their life just playing video games. He also cites one study that found, by 21, in 2010, when the game Call of Duty Black Ops came out, within its first month, collectively, people had played this game for 68,000 years. That's how much time, if you take everybody playing this game all put together. So more screen time. The next thing is more porn. I've done, I think, 3 or 4 lectures on porn here. If I start talking about this, I'm just going to talk all day. So I'm just going to, that's all we're going to say. There's more porn. And the final thing is more years under mom's roof. And Sass is all for intergenerational households. He's all for mixed households, single people, married people, people at different stages of life being together. That's not what he's attacking here. That's not what he's critical of here. He says, for the first time in 130 years, 18 to 34-year-olds in the U.S. were more likely to be living in their parents' home than with a spouse or a partner than in their old household. And I have to say, as someone who has done this with not only his own parents' basement, but his in-laws' house as well, this is a real thing. I've been there myself. So these are some of the mores, but then he tracks through some of the lesses. He sees less marriage. And again, this is a difficult and complex factor, because many people legitimately don't want to get married, because they've seen are terrible, broken homes. That's what they've experienced. Or there are people on the other side who want to be married but can't find someone who will marry them. There's people that want that. Again, that's not what Sass is after here. Singleness is a wonderful, healthy vocation that's necessary. But what he sees is a growing trend of people saying, marriage and commitment, it's too much for me. Let's just cohabitate. Let's live together. It's a little safer. We'll test this thing out. People saying things like, I could never do that. That's too much for me. People that are shirking responsibility and afraid of the financial disincentive or the drudgery of a lifelong commitment and would rather just do their own thing. That's what he's after here. The next is less religious practice. And even though he's a Christian person, he comes at this through a sociological lens. And there's all sorts of aspects to this, but he says this is a place, religious communities were places where young people would learn morals, learn there's something beyond themselves to help them differentiate between right or wrong, as well as a place to have relationships with people in different seasons of life. The final thing in his more and less is, he gives us one more intellectual fragility. He talks about more and more young people being insulated from the big, difficult, and important questions of what it means to be a human. This is an idea that has been put forward in a book by Jonathan Haidt and Gregory Loukianoff, The Coddling of the American Mind. And as you read this, this sort of sounds like he's just blaming millennials. We've heard all of this before, right? This is the get off my grass, right? Get off my lawn approach to cultural analysis. And that is not Sass's intent at all. That is not what he is after. He says, these problems are very significantly the result of broader cultural assumptions about parenting, about education, about life itself, and the nature of adolescence. So he's saying these things are downstream, that millennials, that young people, that are emerging adults who are showing these characteristics of a perpetual adolescence, they're not necessarily just to blame. This is what they've been given. Two intellectual architects for these broader cultural assumptions that are something of the arch-villains of Sass's account are child psychologist Benjamin Spock and educational theorist John Dewey. He spends significantly more time with Dewey than with Spock. But Spock helped spawn a youth culture where children didn't need time around older, wiser, authoritative adults to guide them, to correct them. They were to discover themselves apart from these influences and presence. The job of an adult was to give kids as much space, protected safe space as possible for them to realize all of this. Which was well-intended, but Sass says has spun out of control and made cultivating self-esteem paramount, marginalizing competing concerns about cultivating virtue. And Sass says virtue there is moral strength. And then, so we have Spock on the one hand, and then he has Dewey, John Dewey, on the other side, the influential educational theorist who is... he has sort of designed, on Sass's read, the American high school right now. And he wants the school to become the center of a child's life. Not the home, not the community. What goes on at school is all the real primary formation. And it's for the sake of the individual, not the broader community. And Sass says when these two aspects about the school being the center of life and formation, as well as this coddling approach that comes from Benjamin Spock, he says it saps our kids' agency. It saps their agency. And all of this actually took place, too, under the loving, soft glow of a television screen or a computer screen. This all happened during the emergence and dominance, really, of electronic media. Sass calls electronic media a total discourse medium. He says, where little to nothing is off limits for discussion. And since the medium itself doesn't know or care who's watching it, who's taking it in, the medium effectively adultifies children while infantilizing adults. So he paints a gloomy picture of this perpetual adolescence. But he has a response. His boot camp meets great books program. He doesn't call it that. Emma Green calls it that. The Atlantic article. But he calls it an active program, and it has these five, he calls them character-building habits for young people, or dominion-discovering practices, ways in which young people can discover again they have agency. They can do things with the world. And the first one is to discover the body. And by that, he means our bodies, both its potential and its frailty. He says, youth culture is obsessed with youth, and there's no space for people who are in any other season of life. And so he wants young people to break free from the tyranny of being insulated by one generation and discover the dignity of the body through various seasons of life. He's arguing for intergenerational relationships here, for young people to know older people, for teenagers to know young kids, for young parents to know older parents. He's saying we need to have these relationships across the age spectrum. Too much of our culture is streamlined. You're going to be around people who are in the same season of life. And Sass references the research of an anthropologist named Alice Schlegel, who studied 186 pre-industrial cultures and found that age segregation is almost always closely correlated to antisocial behavior, and the socialization that happens is always for competitiveness and aggression. Again, Sass is always giving anecdotes and sort of ancient moral wisdom, and he's backing it up with sociological research or psychological research. He spent all that time in school. He wants to share some of that with. The second thing is to develop a work ethic. So Sass walks readers through a brief history of the Puritans, early Americans, their theology of the goodness of work, which also entailed the human capacity for persistence and problem solving, dealing with problems and figuring out what to do with them. He said was secularized in sort of early America and just turned into an American work ethic. And during this section of the book, he tells fun sort of anecdotal stories about working on a farm as a kid or sending his 14-year-old daughter to spend a summer on a cattle ranch, where she does all the sorts of things you do on a cattle ranch. It's a fun read. But he also engages here with the work of Arthur Brooks, who is a social scientist, who prior to that was actually, I think, a professional saxophone guy. Yeah, he's the happiness guy. This guy Brooks has worked through lots and lots of studies on happiness. And he's boiled happiness down to four key components, which Sass wants to talk about. The first is to have faith, a framework to help us make sense of suffering and death. The second is family, which by that he just means a home life where there's care, where there's affection. The third is community, at least two real friends to share your pain with, as well as to share your joys with. And the last thing is work. He says work. Arthur Brooks says work is one of the most significant components to being happy, to living a good life. He says, when you leave for work on Monday morning, do you believe that there are other people who genuinely benefit from the work you do? Is your calling, Sass is really big on rediscovering vocation, not just occupation in regards to work, is your calling meaningful? It's not about being well compensated or being praised. It's about, does your work matter? From here, Sass moves on to the trait of limited consumption. He is worried, and these are his words, that anyone who swims so completely in a sea of material surplus, as all of us do, as to be unaware of the virtues of a simple life, is flirting with a great moral risk. in an age in which false prophets are everywhere announcing that consuming the best, the prettiest, and the most is what will satisfy you, a true adult, a true person, will humbly but skeptically ask questions informed by the wisdom of earlier ages, which says that isn't the key to a good life. The next practice is, he says, learn how to travel and to travel light. And this is maybe where that New York Times article that said it was for well-to-do parents, maybe this is where Sass evidences some of that, the ability to travel. But he encourages travel as a means not to be a tourist, not to just see cool things in other places. He sees it as a means to learn the important habit of seeing distinction. What makes one place that place, one culture that culture, and what makes you, you, and your culture, to learn to see distinctions. It's somewhat of a philosophy of travel, not just tourism, but a means to learn about ourselves and about the world that we live in and what people have done with the world they find themselves in. The last, and you might expect this from someone who has all those master's degrees and PhD, build a bookshelf. And learning how to read and deciding what is worth your time reading is a virtue, an important thing to have in a culture of digital media where there are endless distractions in your pocket right now. It can keep you from what is important. Becoming truly literate is a choice. It's not a passive activity like staring at a screen. He says good books engage us and challenge us. They require attention, engagement, and active questioning. So Sass, in a somewhat audacious move that he's aware of, presents something of his own canon. Books he thinks you should read. And he breaks it down into 12 categories. Okay, he is a super organized person. He's an adult. The first section you should read on is God. Here he recommends Genesis, he recommends the Gospel of Matthew, he recommends Luther and Calvin. He owns the fact that he himself is a Christian, and if you're not a Christian reading this book, you should also, one, know about the Christian faith, but know about the greats of your own faith. He's presenting his canon. He's not telling you everyone needs to read this. But this is his recommendation. From there, he goes to the Greeks, the roots of our civilization, Aristotle, Plato, Homer. From there, a section he calls Homesick Souls, which is really the human condition. He recommends everything from Augustine's Confessions to Rousseau's Emile. And Augustine and Rousseau are sort of, for those who know, are like, in Sass's account, they're the two ways of thinking about being human, and they're sort of dueling with each other all throughout The Vanishing American Adult. The next, Bill Shakespeare. After that, he thinks you need to learn about the American idea, what it means to be American. Of course, if you're not an American, if you're Canadian, perhaps, it's a good thing. But he wants us to understand where we've come from and why we are who we are. So he encourages reading and knowing the founding documents, reading Alexis de Tocqueville, reading Frederick Douglass. So reading broadly on what it means to be American. Next, he thinks you should read about the marketplace. You should know about the marketplace. The next section is tyrants, the great tyrants of history. So Marx to Animal Farm, all sorts of things, to know that the world is full of people who take advantage of and hurt other people, whose dominion slides to what? Does anyone remember that? Domination. Yes, there we go. Yes. The next is he encourages you to read on the humanistic perspectives on the sciences. So know the nature of things, how the world actually works. The ninth section is American fiction, from Steinbeck to Twain to Baldwin to Ellison. There's a lot to read. And if, at this point, if you're thinking, we're nine in, and how could he have already left out who knows what, he leaves the last three blank. He's open for you to tell him what he should be reading instead. I was shown this to Sarah, and she immediately said, poetry. Where's poetry? So in wrapping this up, I commend this book. It is a book that takes a sober look at a real problem, perpetual adolescence, and it gives not a perfect game plan, but something of a game plan on how to instill dominion, agency, what he calls self-reliance, in our young people. And again, Sass's approach is not the get-off-my-lawn approach to engaging young people. It's instead saying, hey, why don't you come cut my lawn? And while you're at it, why don't you help me clean the gutters? And then let's talk about what really matters in life. Let's talk about the great works of history, and let's talk about you. So I commend this book. And on that note, I'm going to transition to Sarah.